Good morning, everyone, and welcome to day two of the ELI annual meeting. I thought we would get a prompt start because we want to have as much time with our keynote speaker today as we can. You know, the question about how we can measure learning is a really old one. No news to anyone in this room, I'm sure. You know, I was always impressed. A year or two ago, I asked a room filled with folks such as us in teaching and learning whether grades is some way of measuring learning. And I said, if you thought that, raise your hand. And almost nobody raised their hand. So the question is, if grades don't do it, then what does it? And now we're in this era of that's called now big data. And there's lots of promises about the way that big data can help us to understand the learning of our students and to help us improve our teaching. And so the question is that promise merited? And what are the best paths into that space? And what ones perhaps are false leads? So I'm very, very pleased to be able to introduce our keynote speaker, who's going to share with us his thoughts for to help us navigate into the era of big data. Dr. Roy P. is the David Jacks Professor of Education and the Learning Sciences at Stanford University, co-founder and director of the HSTAR Institute, director of the PhD program in Learning Sciences and Design. Since 1981, Dr. P. has been exploring how information technologies can support and advance the scientific understanding and practices of learning and teaching, with particular focus on topics in science, mathematics, and technology education, and their symbolic and communicative interchanges that are integral to learning. He is a fellow of the National Academy of Education, Association for Psychological Science, the Center for Advanced Study in Behavioral Sciences, the American Educational Research Association, and was an IBM faculty fellow in 2006. In 2004 2005, Dr. P. was of the International Society for Learning Sciences. Dr. P. received his PhD in developmental psychology from the University of Oxford, England, where he was a Rhodes Scholar. He is co-author of the 2010 National Education Technology Plan for the U.S. Department of Education, was co-author of the 2007 volume Video Research in Learning Sciences, and co-author of the 2000 National Academy volume How People Learn. And so it is my great pleasure to be able to introduce and welcome to the ELI annual meeting Dr. Roy P.
Thank you, Malcolm, and good morning, everyone. Glad to see you out here in Denver, bright and early. So I'm going to talk about a time for a marriage and give you some ways that I think learning sciences and learning analytics need to connect. But first, let's start with some assessments of the current state of U.S. education, which don't encourage many of us. You can see in the PISA rankings, we're down in 31st place in mathematics, in science, 23rd. Even in reading, we are 17th. And our problems start early. 6 out of 10 low-income U.S. fourth graders do not do math at grade level. At college, you probably know these numbers well, nearly 40% of Hispanic kids drop out of high school and only 10% complete an associate's degree or higher. Under 10% of white kids drop out of high school, and 32% of them complete associates or higher. We rank 20th for high school graduation rate out of those countries. Only 71% of our students complete high school. And although we were first as recently as the 1970s, we now are 15th for our college graduation rates among 27 countries. To this end, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation have developed an ambitious goal, and I think it's a 17-year plan, to have 80% of high school students graduate college ready with a focus on low-income and minority youth. And that is intended to address what some describe as the U.S. dropout factory, where 7 out of 10 don't graduate with at least an associate's degree from college. These are NCES data. Many education reforms are concerned, of course, with equitable access to education, and actors and funders are tackling these issues from research, policy, technology, and entrepreneurial perspectives. And into this context comes MOOCs. Of course, I had to say MOOCs in the first 3 minutes. That's a MOOC. Nobody cannot know the answer, right? The pace is truly astounding. Coursera, funded by several faculty on leave from Stanford, have signed up 33 top-tier university partners offering over 200 courses and 2.4 million students from almost 200 countries. Udacity is on a roll as well with a different model. EdX is going a little more slowly, but with a lot of effort for pedagogical sophistication. And there's a long list of contenders. Stanford also has a board-funded Class2Go new open platform. So the universities that have partnered with Coursera are quite a list. Udacity has a stunning set of courses. EdX is building up a pipeline. And yet, the headlines, and I mean thousands of headlines, we've been doing a bit of tracking of this. Just last week at Davos, we had Thomas Friedman of Flat Earth fame interviewing a panel, including a 12-year-old Pakistani girl who's taken a number of Udacity courses in physics and AI. And the Harvard Business Review blog says that the advent of MOOCs is the single most important technological development of the millennium. Now, I started scratching my head. They're certainly important. But, you know, egg stem cells, ultra-efficient solar cells, 3D transistors, cancer genomics, social indexing, gestural interfaces, cloud streaming, solid-state batteries for electric cars. So there are a few other things that are contenders, right? But so what's going on? Certainly there's an attention that's leveraging thousands of years of university brands. I think it's worth thinking about that for a moment. Thousands of years of university brands. And of course the important labeling of open and online. Even without credit, though, that too is changing. Yet for all the enthusiasm, there is fear, trepidation, and stunning framings of the import of MOOCs for the world. Stanford President John Hennessy calls this the campus tsunami. Former president of Princeton and Mellon Foundation, President William Bowen, in his recent Tanner lectures at Stanford, asks for the higher education cost disease question, is technology the answer? And he urges that it is. Columbia University Humanities Prof. Del Banco, discussing that, reminded us that tsunamis do not pick their targets. And even more, he quoted Thoreau's Walden, who we might not have expected to write about MOOCs. Walden, Thoreau says, we do not ride on the railroad. It rides upon us. Learners, faculty, universities may be the rails. The quote in full goes, we do not ride on the railroad. It rides upon us. Each one is a man. The rails are laid on them, and they are covered with sand, and the cars run smoothly over them. They are sound sleepers, I assure you. And every few years, a new lot is laid down and run over, so that if some have the pleasure of riding on a rail, others have the misfortune to be ridden upon. Certainly, his highlights about industrialization may have some counterparts, depending on where you work in the world of higher education. So, however, I will not talk about the economics of higher education today, the future of universities, the implications of MOOCs for faculty identity or workload, the global appetite for MOOC experience, although these are all great topics, because I want to focus our attention on the nature of learning in and worth and with MOOCs. And I can't resist MOOC hysteria, this amazing poster, something new in shock thriller education, and headlines such as from the ACM, when MOOCs destroy academia. So, largely missing in a great chasm between their designs in the learning sciences. Why? I mean, the founding model, if not the dominant model, it's changing, is depicted in this image from a recent New York Times op-ed piece from Thomas Friedman on the importance of MOOCs that exemplifies a prototypic design. The transmission model of education is so familiar, so comfortable, to many in the academy, and the open availability of lectures from well-known professors at esteemed universities is such a flood of learning material to learn from in this familiar modality that it may seem heretical to even challenge the model or its assumption and implications. Khan Academy-style videos, multiple-choice short-answer questions. Of course, there are new developments but all the same, are there alternatives? So I'd like to shine a light on an alternative, at least a complementary advance on this modal MOOC model, recognizing that MOOCs are fast developing and already beginning to incorporate alternative pedagogies such as team projects, automatically scored computer programs, and peer assessments. So just a couple years ago, the U.S. Department of Education released the Obama administration's National Education Technology Plan. We had a phenomenal technical working group drafting the NETP, orchestrated by SRI's Barbara Means as project director, working with Jim Shelton, Karen Cater, and other talented U.S. Department of Ed staff. And we solicited as well thousands of publicly contributed case studies, technologies, research, and other national resources that animate the details of the plan. While the central focus of our plan was K-12, and I know you're largely a higher ed group, we were expressly devoted to developing a plan for learning not only in classrooms, but in homes, in informal environments, and in the college years and beyond to an American education powered by technology throughout the lifespan. This was the first time a national ed tech plan had had such a focus. Now, I ask you to bear with me as I explore the relevancies of this strategic document for the issues you're concerned with in the ELI. Consider learning prospects today. The amount of time kids spend in school from K to 12 is roughly a million minutes. It's interesting to keep a figure like that in mind, a million minutes. It may seem like a lot of time to learn, and that's only in school, which comprises but 20% of the awake time of the student, but how do we spend it today? Largely in hour-long classes with seat time requirements, students grouped by age, lecture-based teaching, looks like the MOOCs, paper textbook is the primary learning resource, and very small data, limited testing feedback, just a few reports, attendance records, whether you're free lunch eligible, and mobiles are often banned. We really wanted to have a very different model than that, a different vision that would be informed by the learning sciences and powered by technology with these going assumptions into the plan's development, that advances in the learning sciences give us valuable insights into how people learn, a new recognition of the lifelong and life-wide learning ecologies and how they require new designs, and how technology innovations give us abilities to act on these insights as never before. And some of you may ask, what are the learning sciences anyway? So I owe you two slides on this. Advancing scientific understanding of learning is one major focus, but a twin focus is engaging in design, implementation, and assessment of learning innovations. It had its origins in the late 80s with major fields of the cognitive sciences, computer sciences, education psychology, anthropology. And over that 25-year period or so, the learning sciences has expanded to a concern with pedagogical knowledge of teachers, curriculum design, informal learning, policy innovations, and even the learning neurosciences. We have a professional society, two archival journals, the Journal of Learning Sciences and IJCSCL, each of which are high impact in education, and at this point over 40 different learning sciences graduate programs in the United States and abroad from a humble start with one at Northwestern 20 years ago. So what were the five goals of the National EdTech Plan? The first one I want to spend the most time on is that it puts students at the center, not faculty, not curriculum developers, and it empowers them to take control of their learning. The model asks that we change what and how we teach to match what people need to know, how they learn, where and when they will learn, not only in school, and to support everyone who needs to learn. It calls for bringing state-of-the-art technology into learning in meaningful ways to engage and motivate, to inspire students to achieve. And while all five goals and their corresponding chapters in this document are of fundamental relevance to your concerns, I want to emphasize the first three, learning, assessment, and teaching. So this alternative version, this learner-centered framework, note that student in the middle, is a framework for an always-on network world. This is what we're shooting for, hoping to be able to presuppose soon. Unlike today's classrooms in this diagram, a single teacher transmitting the same information to all learners in the same way, the model puts students at the center, empowers them to take control of their learning, providing flexibility in a bunch of dimensions. Standards-based concepts and competencies form the basis of what they should learn. But beyond that, students and educators have diverse options to engage in learning tailored to their goals, needs, and interests. And as part of this plan for a 21st century learning powered by technology, the plan envisions ways of using large-scale data from online learning systems to improve instruction. As students work, evidence can be collected of their problem-solving sequences, knowledge, strategy use, reflected by choices that they make, information that they enter, numbers of attempts they make, the hints, the feedback, and time allocations. And it's important to highlight that contributions to classroom discourse and learning activities whose traces are not today captured digitally will continue to be important. It's not only a world in which digital traces are the only ones that should inform what we do. And beyond school learning time per se, mobiles enable a continual connectedness to learning resources. E-text, the web, social capital, and friends and family. So it's possible to establish a connected learning world that bridges in and out of school experiences, inquiry science, math learning games, deep reading and writing about informational texts. And this is true building up through college and into senior years as well. What about teaching? In that case, and a similar model from the plan that we call connected teaching, educators are fully instrumented with 24/7 access to data about student learning, analytical tools helping them act on the insights the data provide, and they're connected not only to their students but to professional content, resources, and systems that empower them to create and manage and assess engaging and relevant learning experiences for students in and out of school. They're connected to resources and expertise to help them improve their instructional practices while facilitating their students' increasingly self-directed learning. So this was certainly an exciting plan to work on. It was well received in many respects, but we still have significant digital divides. The vision has a lot of missing parts in the world, in device and network access, but also importantly in terms of knowledge and social networks for effective practices of digital learning. And I just highlight here the LEAD Commission, which is a very substantial private-public partnership effort underway to facilitate this move towards connected learning and teaching future. What I'd like to draw your attention to next is that we called out personalized learning as a grand challenge problem in the National Education Technology Plan in these ambitious terms. To design and validate an integrated system that provides real-time access to learning experiences tuned to the levels of difficulty and assistance that optimize learning for all learners, and that incorporates self-improving features that enable it to become increasingly effective through interaction with learners. We went on to note that such systems would need to discover appropriate learning resources and configure them in ways and modes of expression that are appropriate for the age, prior knowledge, reading ability, and language, and to select appropriate paths and scaffold for moving a learner through those resources with the optimal level of challenge and support. For anyone working in digital learning or in education, you can see that this is a very significant grand challenge, but you can also imagine making progress on parts of it, which is one of the things that makes a grand challenge problem such a thing. So we do have systems that can recommend learning resources that a person might like, learning materials with embedded tutoring, learning management systems that do move individuals through sets of learning materials and keeping track of their progress, but we do not have integrated systems that perform all these functions dynamically while optimizing engagement and learning for all learners. And yet, such systems are essential for implementing the personalized learning called for in the plan. What progress is underway on this grand challenge problem? So at the heart of this issue is learning analytics, and I like Eric Duvall's short definition, which is about collecting traces learners leave behind and using those traces to improve learning. Now, learning analytics should be able to inform personalized adaptive learning pathways through online learning systems that can better support learning for everyone, recommended learning resources, more engaging and inspiring learning. And learning analytics is all about patterns and prediction, about algorithms for identifying the pattern in the data to infer learner's knowledge, their intentions, their interests, in predicting what should come next, and trying to provide the appropriate response or learning resource to advance their progress. We want to ask whether we could identify students' difficulties early, provide the kinds of support they need, and we can foresee large-scale test beds to do experiments in what we might call comparative pedagogy, testing alternative theories of how to teach a subject, such as fractions in elementary school. So in the remainder of my talk, I'd like to foreground six priority connections for learning sciences and learning analytics. I'll spend most of my time on the front end, because I'm going to run out of it otherwise. The six bullets are these: developing interconnected learning maps, designing for engaged social learning, educating for broader competencies than the cognitive, using richer pedagogical models, better understanding learner goals, and forging interdisciplinary teams. Let me begin on developing connected learning maps. So there's been a long-time vision, going back to Vannevar Bush's MEMEX, of guided learning paths through complex learning resources and challenges that are encountered. Bush's MEMEX, in his As We May Think essay, was a technical fantasy, but it inspired the inventors of personal computing and hypertext, Doug Engelbart, Ted Nelson, Andy Van Dam, and the inventors of the web and browsers. A key aspect of the plot of Neal Stephenson's Diamond Age, a sci-fi masterpiece, centers on young protagonist Nell, a low working class girl who receives a stolen copy of a very interactive book, The Young Lady's Illustrated Primer, designed for an upper class child, and she learns through the personalized learning supports of the primer as it adapts folk stories to her life circumstances, and she's taught what she most needs in her environment to live and to thrive. Now, I want to share with you some, I think, very meaningful lessons from Danny Hillis in his recent talk at OSCON. Danny's an exceptional inventor and an engineer who developed the award-winning and influential Connection Machine, an early parallel supercomputer. He became vice president of R&D for Walt Disney Imagineering and today co-leads a group called Applied Minds. He's now working on the open technologies for addressing the grand challenge problems of the National Ed Tech Plan and advancing the conditions that make that vision possible. He tells a story where he likens the technology we need to do this to his fourth grade librarian, Mrs. Wilner, who recognized what interested Danny most after he kept asking for books on rocks. She kept asking him questions, recommending material that would most engage him and supplement his core education, his books on electricity, or a science fiction story about a boy who built a rocket ship, which he says he still thinks about today. I had my own with Mrs. Wilner. This is my second grade teacher on the right, Miss Lithridge. I think she must have been trained by Dewey personally. On the bottom, you see my roots. Those are my great-great-grandparents born in the 1830s on a farm. In the middle at the bottom is my father, barefooted in his one-room schoolhouse. And he was the first to leave the farm, and so I literally had the first exposure to libraries in my family's past. So Mrs. Wilner's are very important, and Mrs. Lithridge was one of mine. And so Danny highlights how in today's education materials, the student model is bundled in with the materials, and that this is a problem. A text assumes what a person knows, and the assessment is more about whether you read the book than whether you have any interest in it. He suggests a better paradigm that I think is convergent with the one we envision in the National Education Technology Plan, in which he describes how greater personalization of learning has to involve interoperability, the interconnectedness of the following: of a learning map for a domain with learning resources tagged to be pointing into that map, assessments as to where the learner is in those maps, a model of the student continuously informed by data about their performances and choices and interests, and applications that exploit such open web services. As he notes, this does not require artificial intelligence, simply enough of a model to do something useful in moving you as the learner through the map and directing you to learning resources and experience. And he notes how we need something that ties all this together, an open data structure with an API, an application programmer interface, and which has represented in it everything that everyone needs to know. This open data structure, he foregrounds, is a collaborative object in which any teachable, accessible skill is a node, and it shows its relationship to other skills from multi-digit addition with carrying to designing space rocketry. So the image is that personalized learning through learning maps can enable one's interests to be pursued and their preferred media or genre of learning resources selected, whether it's stories, theories, facts, visualizations, and the like. So note how the remix, the mashup ideology of the open education resource movement and open learning maps and standards presumes that many can play in this space, for-profit and nonprofit players alike, in an interoperable way with data aggregation over services from curriculum to assessment and beyond. And for K-12, we have moved in this direction with the Common Core standards in math and English language arts, and broad-scale adoption through some 46 states. Now, if you don't spend much time on K-12, I would urge you to look at this nationwide deliberative effort to create standards as it's built upon knowledge from research on learning progressions in K-12 from the learning sciences, international comparative STEM learning and curriculum studies, policy research, state school leadership and practitioner organization involvement, philanthropic foundations, and exceptional leadership. This heavy lifting community developed initiative has no university level counterpart for the thousands of universities and colleges in this country and in the world. Learning maps in MOOCs and in higher education generally are based more on faculty intuitions than empirical science for the most part. And yet building interconnected university level learning maps across the disciplines and programs of study, I would say, is an urgent priority for personalized learning to be achieved at this level of education. It can't only be K-12 that works on learning maps. So the technical architecture that Hillis believes will make this work includes open source servers that serve standardized representations of learning maps and models of learner competencies based on evidence of assessed learning from interacting with learning resources. He calls upon the Learning Resource Metadata Initiative, which has developed standards for tagging learning resources and will reference this learning map. And the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is paying for many parts of this vision and supporting people to build pieces of it. Applied Minds has been building a reference architecture for these open servers. So who's working on learning maps? There are a number of efforts which have been working on different aspects of this. The LearnLab data shop in Pittsburgh provides several services to the learning sciences community, a central repository for secure logging of research data and reporting and analysis tools. Data reports and queries are rendered via the web on request with over 300 data sets. Each curriculum domain employs a learning map. Assessments with Worcester Polytechnic and broad implementation in Massachusetts. Thousands of teachers provide lessons with hints and formative assessments and data visualizations. And again, a learning map is at the center. In Newton's work with Pearson, products that are used by hundreds of thousands of students in developmental programs in math, English, and writing, their adaptive learning platform is said to identify each student's strengths and weaknesses and use algorithms to provide daily personalized learning paths for every student. Dreambox focuses on grade 1 to 4 math, where exercises are adapted in terms of difficulty and scaffolding and sequencing and the number and types of hints given, pacing, and other features of the learning experience. Grokket claims to be the social learning company, making products to help people learn from other people. And they predict student performances with diagnostic quizzes, group and solo lessons, and personalized study plans. Learning as you learn, again, it focuses on learning maps. But the key thing to highlight here is that these maps are unconnected. They are unconnected. And it is like the early days of the 1980s when there were multiple hypertext systems. I used to go to conferences on hypertext systems, believe it or not, with 1,000 people. And this made sense before the web and its associated standards created a compelling integrated approach. So a few words about the shared learning collaborative. It's a central element to this developing story of a socio-technical infrastructure for personalized learning. It's an alliance of states and foundations, educators and content providers, all passionate about this concept of personalized learning. And it's the Council of Chief State School Officers has been central in developing the vision. With 9 participating states representing 11 million students, they are working to accelerate how U.S. public schools move towards personalized learning by creating a set of open shared technology services. And I want to play a brief cartoon oriented to teachers, but nonetheless useful for us today. And of course, in YouTube.
Here's a teacher with just a few of the students in a typical classroom. Brandon and Maria and Karen and Jimmy. Each is unique. They're at different stages and need different ways to get where they need to go. She has ideas for how to help each one, but to do that forces her to focus on each student, think about the teaching tools and approaches that help each student on their journey, deal with truckloads of student data that may or may not work together or with other teaching materials she likes to use, then come up with a specific plan and get the best lessons and content for it. And the tools for all of this just add more complexity. As a result, it's nearly impossible for her to give each of her students exactly what they need, unless she has better tools. And the Shared Learning Collaborative is creating shared data services to make data speak the same language and make it easier to create teaching materials that work with that data, which opens the door to creating new, customized learning maps and curriculum, along with an engine to easily find and share them. So when Maria needs an extra challenge to keep her engaged with math, or Brandon needs a different approach to reading, one that works with his love of spaceships, it's at her fingertips. It also helps her turn that flood of assessment and formative data into something that gives actual insight, so she can see exactly where they are and what they need and adapt in real time. Tools that give teachers better access to information from each other, across the hall or across the country. The SLC has launched the services necessary to build better tools for our teachers and classrooms, including a cloud-based data store, standardized metadata tagging language, and an open license API for building software applications, which will help developers make software that actually works together, giving teachers easy access to data and resources for the millions of students already waiting to benefit from what can be created from these shared services. And as more schools join, we get lower integration costs, more meaningful data, and better tools for everybody. SLC has made some examples just to hint at the possibilities. This means that teachers are free to teach personally, while developers can meet new challenges and even create new possibilities for every student in just the right way. Shared services work best when they're truly shared. SLC is making that sharing happen now. Join in.
And so the Shared Learning Collaborative has created open license and non-proprietary software stacks that include the kinds of things you were learning about there, from data stores to middleware, from dashboards to learning maps and APIs. It's recently been renamed inbloom.org and moving forward with that approach. I'm very glad to see that the Shared Learning Collaborative developed very much in the spirit of our recommendations to the National Science Foundation a few years ago, where we highlighted fostering learning in a networked world. And the first bullet I want to emphasize, that of all the transformational catalysts brought by the internet and the web as technology infrastructures, perhaps the most fundamental is that innovators and entrepreneurs can draw upon shared interoperable services and platforms. So this point is truly fundamental. It's fundamental for K-12, it's fundamental for higher ed, and I know that many of you recognize this, and yet there are challenges in the business of higher education and technology platforms these days that may get in the way of that. So there are qualitative transformations underway from small to big data in education. I've already highlighted how little data there are in student information systems today. But with digital learning, we'll have a deluge of K-12 data, five orders of magnitude greater than our slim data today. And of course, in other fields, and I don't need to belabor this, big data science has had tremendously impactful work. And yet, big data in education has been missing. We will need education data scientists who are prepared by training and state-of-the-art data science tools and theory, but for the education domain. Because as learning goes deeply digital, as learning management systems and MOOCs and their follow-ups become part of the learning technology ecosystem, with deep couplings of student interactions with curriculum problems, projects, and vastly more data on learning performances in their context than schools have ever had to make sense of before. Now, finally, that was my first bullet. So I did burn most of my time on bullet one. I think it's so important. The second priority connection between learning sciences and learning analytics is designing for engaged social learning. So while engaged social learning was certainly a central theme in our national EdTech plan, it's a profound design requirement in MOOCs, where tens of thousands of students cannot expect a single interaction with a faculty member. Our onus has to be to create designs for social learning that are at a synchronous scale that's never really been attempted in previous research or practices with online education. New norms are essential in this. Norms of a digital learning commons in which every learner is a teacher, in which the distributed expertise of participants is recognized, in which it's really easy to ask and answer questions, to find people who will serve as learning guides and brokers. We need to design for this distributed intelligence within these large learning environments, and with that, supporting these new norms. We should also expect from prior research with online communities that user profiles and associated reputation systems in economies can contribute integrally to engaged social learning. And we also need, in these new online environments, computer-supported collaborative learning technologies. This is a field with 20 years of results and insights on tool features. It's important to foster joint attention, mediated over the networks, and deep tagging of learning resources, including videos, about which questions are being asked. It's very hard to establish a common reference in the current world of MOOCs. So my third connection between learning sciences and learning analytics has to do with educating for broader competencies. There's a really excellent report I want to refer you to from the National Research Council on education for life and work, funded by a number of foundations to develop a consensus report to sort out all the discussion of 21st century skills, deeper learning, learning for transfer. And they developed a preliminary classification of skills and abilities, talked about the importance of deeper learning, which I'll define in a moment, and what one needs to do to teach and assess for that and develop systems that will support it. The first thing to highlight, and I'm glad to see this because I think neither 21st century nor skills is the right rendering. If anybody believes that in 2090 you're going to need exactly the same things you need today, hold up your hand. I don't. And skills is too narrow. They focus on dimensions of expertise that are both specific to and intertwined with knowledge within a particular domain of content and performance. And to reflect our view, they say that skills and knowledge are so intertwined we use the term competencies rather than skills, and I favor that as well. They also want to hire these skills are not so 21st century. Of course, we see an ancient Greek discourse going on here. They view the various sets of terms that are called 21st century as reflecting human dimensions that have been important for really many centuries rather than skills suddenly new, unique, and valuable today. And they spent a fair amount of time sorting out three broad domains of competencies. And by and large, we tend to focus in our education systems and certainly in MOOCs on the first categories, the cognitive. But you also see a real emphasis on a number of dimensions of intrapersonal competency, such as intellectual openness and initiative, appreciation for diversity, and interpersonal in terms of teamwork, collaboration, leadership, and the like. And the moral here for today is that as K-12 and higher education moves more substantially online and comprehensive integrative learning maps are developed to which digital learning resources and emerging learning competencies are tagged, we need to heed and incorporate these three broad domains of competencies, not only the cognitive. So what about this concept of deeper learning? Many of us have called it learning for understanding, learning for transfer. In this report, they define deeper learning as the process through which an individual becomes capable of taking what was learned in one situation and applying it to new ones. It's a very much of a social activity, but its product is transferable knowledge. And the point is that we need richer assessments than we tend to have. What does it mean to teach for deeper learning? And here there are a lot of lessons in this report for those that aspire to create inspirational MOOCs that do more than cover existing content. First, in K-12, which is their emphasis, I won't detail each of the topics here other than to say they build substantially on meta-analyses from the Institute of Education Sciences and other reports on the importance of multiple representations, on the importance of encouraging elaboration and questioning and explanations, of engaging learnings in challenging tasks while at the same time giving them guidance. I would hasten to say that while MOOCs have many challenging tasks, there's been a lot less guidance, and the dropout rate is one indication of that. Teaching with worked examples and cases, connecting to students' personal lives and interest. And throughout college, we have similar issues. I would say that teaching for deeper learning is as fundamental in college as it is in K-12. The difference, of course, is that we have more advanced learning topics and one hopes greater engagement with research apprenticeships and work-related internships in some academic programs. The fourth connection between learning sciences and learning analytics we need to prioritize is the use of richer pedagogical models. This would be a great topic for a semester-long course. Each of these has a very substantial research base behind it. Project-based learning, problem-based learning, as in medicine, but in other fields as well, business. Complex system modeling, learning in virtual worlds, computer games, simulations for learning, immersive and embodied learning, learning by argumentation, a very substantial literature there, knowledge-building communities, arguing to learn, got that in there twice, it must be important, that's an argument, I guess. So these richer pedagogical models are not only for learning alone, I want to underscore that, but for learning together. They span really diverse technologies, simulations and virtual worlds. Collaboration scripts have been very important in knowledge building communities online in the CSCL literature. And there are new genres of technology and user experiences, tangible computing, haptic interfaces that need to be attended to as well. And so the idea here is that learning, whether it's in the STEM disciplines or beyond, can be profoundly transformed with a greater emphasis on learners interacting with complex data and systems, experimenting with sensor data and simulations on topics such as climate change, bridge designs, protein folding, ecosystems, and students can explore patterns of relationship and key principles with what-if modeling in such environments. A fifth connection of importance, and I'm not going to say much about this, although I'll underscore its importance, is we need to understand learner goals. We have a lab of students at Stanford across three or four departments that call themselves the Lytics Lab that have been looking at the data sets from all the Coursera courses that Stanford has offered. And there are some there and, of course, in other courses, low MOOC completion rates that indicate some problems that really need to be solved. Why are learners participating? There is such a diversity of people in terms of walks of life, stages in the lifespan, conditions of their participation, what they're there for. Why are they exiting the course or bypassing its assessment elements? A huge group audit and never do any of the assessments. Bypassing learning resources that faculty think of as crucial. How does this relate to issues of academic persistence, to mindset? And what's clear from anybody's looking at dropout rates, if you will, in MOOCs, is that smaller units of learning than courses may well be needed, and certainly greater support. If you look at courses from the Open Learning Initiative, for example, there the focus is on learning curves. People can get hints and tips, and you don't find them dropping out at quite the extent that you do in the world of MOOCs. As a field, it's really clear that we need to forge interdisciplinary teams as we bring together the learning sciences and learning analytics. For this marriage to work, there have to be social scientists, computer scientists, statisticians, learning scientists, education researchers, and disciplinary domain expertise. I think it's really a time for collaboratories for online learning across multiple institutions. Herb Simon, Candace Thiel gave me this lovely quote, said, "Improvement in post-secondary education will require converting teaching from a solo sport to a community-based research activity." He's always been ahead of his time, and I think he's really right here. In newly emerging online learning environments, the solo sport of teaching can be expanded through collaborations for useful feedback for learners, teachers, designers of learning environments. We should all be hopeful that technology can actualize its transformational promises for improving learning for all in this new team sport era. And Candace shares a flow diagram of how integral the synergies of collaboration are across instructional design and instructional technology development, user experience design, domain experts, software developers, learning scientists, in the flow of developing and iterating in a design-based research modality, online courses that they have been offering. I want to briefly allude to a learning analytics workgroup project that I've been leading for a few months here. This is an effort that is designed to make recommendations and scope priorities about new tools and new human capital development needs. We've been bringing together leaders from university, industry, government, and philanthropy. There's a very substantial interest in helping the field move at a pace that it normally would not. As you look around, you will not see degrees in learning analytics anywhere in the world. You can find courses on data science. You can find courses on education data mining. There's a new master's degree in learning engineering from Carnegie Mellon, so they're leading the way on that. But universities on their own will be far too slow. We think the federal government and philanthropic world can help accelerate building this new world. And I want to make a call out here to a really excellent report that is a follow-up to the National EdTech Plan. The U.S. Department of Education had SRI International develop an issue brief on enhancing teaching and learning through educational data mining and learning analytics. And what you see on the right are several dashboards on classroom level or individual learning progress from the Khan Academy, from Assistments, from Dreambox Learning, that are utilizing these approaches to improving education. So what do we need education data scientists working on? Well, it's a pretty big list. There are big modeling challenges, those of you that may be drawn to this. User knowledge modeling, inferring what a user knows by looking at how they interact with learning resources. User behavior modeling, are they on or off task, are they engaged? User experience modeling, is the student satisfied with their learning experiences, bored or ready to quit? User profiling, collecting personal data that categorizes learners based on their characteristic activities. Domain modeling, representing key concepts, thermodynamics, mathematics. Learning component analysis, what are the components of knowledge and skills? Social learning capital, what are the social networks that a learner can tap into to facilitate or broker opportunities to learn, personalization, recommendations, and the like. And of course, the issues of data dashboards are important. And once again, one can't assume that everyone knows how to reason with statistical representation, so that's an important topic as well. In this work of the law project, we've surfaced quite a number of policy, legal, and ethical challenges. And I know that the NRC has a committee that Bob Hauser is about to launch on common rule and opening up IRB in fundamental ways, the Institutional Review Board, if you do human subjects work, which student data at all levels requires. There are many state laws on student data access that may be problematic for data aggregation and learning across states. I want to underscore the stereotype risks from learner labeling. What if we now have hundreds of categories by which students may become labeled? We know that students can often not provide challenging resources or activities for students that they believe are have learning issues. So I think that this is a very vital question, you know, who has what access to what categorizations of learners in these new environments. Of course, teacher and school leader roles will need to change in data-driven decision making. And I see that there'll be a huge business in change management for schools and universities associated with digital learning ecosystems. Is there money to do any of this work? The NSF is concerned. They have a Dear Colleague letter that came out this last year that seeks funding across directorates on this topic. Recently, we met with the NSF director and the leads of several of the divisions, and they are extremely keen to hear from the field about the importance of this area and ready to fund new programs. I would encourage you to take a look at two different professional societies, the International Education Data Mining Society and its associated journal and volumes, the Society for Learning Analytics Research, and a forthcoming meeting in Belgium. I can tell you that after, from my perspective, a disappointing Vancouver meeting where learning science was largely invisible in the discussions of learning analytics, the LAK group pulled together a lot of learning scientists as program committee, and there will be a chock-full program full of efforts at this marriage. I don't want to scoot by without highlighting the number of companies and startups that are very active in learning analytics. I'd say hundreds of millions of dollars have been raised and are in process of being spent to develop systems along these lines. This is surely an incomplete list, but just to give you a sense of how much is going on there, I don't even have the MOOC companies in the list. They're clearly relevant to be represented. So to close, I've surfaced six priority connections that I think are simply vital for learning sciences and learning analytics to come together in a really productive way. Developing interconnected learning maps. In higher education, we have a lot of challenges there, but it really has to get done. Designing for engaged social learning. In some sense, the facelessness of MOOCs makes it all the more crucial for us to find ways to support social learning in those environments. Educating for the broader competencies beyond the cognitive, using richer pedagogical models in ways that I know some of the MOOCs are beginning to do. Better understanding learner goals and forging interdisciplinary teams. And in sum, I do think it's time for a marriage. It might be a difficult dating period, but I think that these fields need very much one another. Thank you. I think we've got a few minutes for questions.
Hi, good morning. Thank you very much, and thank you for spending a lot of time on the learning maps area. My question has to do with domain specificity. Mm-hmm. A lot of what you talked about, API standards, even learning science methods, were more generic. How much of that is actually, well, we need to do that in business, technology, nursing, and domains, and has that come up as an issue?
Yeah, so if you look closely at the scientific foundations of the Common Core standards in mathematics in particular, you'll see that there's a lot of empirical work that looks at prerequisite knowledge conditions and things that students need to learn before they can achieve concepts that build upon those prior concepts. There are, of course, versions of this, whether you're teaching probabilistic graphical modeling or thermodynamics in higher education as well. So there is a domain specificity to that. At the same time, anybody that studies ontology would recognize that courses need to be having their maps crosstalk with one another in ways that are very rare in a university to do. I mean, the course sequencing numbers and prerequisites, you know, if you scratch hard on what the research foundations are for learning behind those, you typically will not find much. So I think there really is an empirical basis that needs to be there. And as more learning goes digital, we can be collecting the kinds of data that can inform those maps.
Thank you.
Hi.
Hi. I'm going to play contrarian for a moment. We see a lot of students coming in. I mean, and first of all, I'm very much in favor of a lot of what you're talking about, but I'm also looking at it from the other side as an educator that one of our biggest challenges at the college level is that students come in with an expectation that they will be led through their learning, and there is no self-direction. And one of our fundamental goals at most institutions is to develop lifelong self-directed learners. But if you're putting them in these maps and these highly structured systems, are we actually taking away their ability to develop that skill?
I would say it's more like orienteering, where if I'm going to be exploring some new terrain, I'm really happy to have a map that lays out the topology, that gives me a sense of where the dead ends are, the cliffs, the streams, where the connections are. And that's the spirit in which I believe these maps will come to function. I don't think it's productive to conceptualize them as something that steers a learner through little gullies and ruts with no ability to choose, no ability to fly up above the map and get a broader context, no ability for teachers to provide choices that are in or out of the maps. I mean, I think it's inevitable that what these maps will provide is one new resource. To think of it as deterministic, I think, is not helpful. So I share your contrarianism if it were thought of as a wiring circuit that a student runs around in like an electron.
Enjoyed your talk very much. I think it's really interesting. One aspect that I was thinking about, and it seems like a major implement to implementing this marriage that you described, is the role of group-based instruction. And that being the current paradigm, it seems that it's really should be differentiated or individualized instruction, and that would change the role of the teacher in the classroom, how teachers are being prepared. Are you involved in conversations about that?
Well, for a lot of my professional career, I've cared a lot about group learning and collaboration. As I mentioned, one of our kind of branches of the learning sciences is computer-supported collaborative learning, so that requires thinking about what that means, what group cognition is and means. So I think it's a really interesting problem. And further, Tom Malone, Sandy Pentland, and others have been doing some work looking at the intelligence of groups as distinct from the intelligence of their members. And there are really interesting properties of groups that learn and perform better across multiple contexts. I point you to a science paper on that topic. And interestingly, they include things that close studies of kind of the microgenesis of collaboration indicator associated with success as well, like in Bridget Barron's work on how smart groups fail. It involves active listening, building on the knowledge of and the moves of the people that are in your group. And interestingly, the groups have a higher group intelligence G that's not predicted by the individual intelligence measures with more women in them. The more women you have, the better they are. And the only way in which men add to the quality of those groups as if they act like women. Oh, I thought you were focusing on the group as the learning unit.
Where,
And is the question how to transition from that to the world like the one that I was describing? Yes, I would suggest chasing down some of the references that are in the report here, because there are success cases that one can learn from. But I appreciate the problem in the large. I don't want to keep you from coffee too long, but is there a last question? Thanks so much for your attention today. I appreciate it.